And I'd like to welcome a new guest in the studio with me, Sayed Mohsen Fatemi, professor of psychology. Thanks so much for being with us. And of course, Sayed Mostafa Khoshchesh, who continues to be with us. Sayed Khoshchesh, when we look at what we were talking about previously, and we're looking at leadership, and we looked at the words of the leader of the Islamic Revolution this week and talking about infiltration. And we see from the time of the Prophet until now, the significance of infiltration. I want you to pick up from there.
Well, we'll just explain about the beginning of Islam. What happened in the next 50 years or 49 years after the Prophet, that they killed his grandson, and he was not an unknown person, he was a very well-known person. And it doesn't mean that people didn't accept him or people did not recognize him as a saint. Yes, even many of his enemies.
Okay, Sayed Khoshchesh, I'm sorry to interrupt you, but we're having some audio difficulties with your microphone. We'll get that taken care of. Meanwhile, crossing over to Sayed Fatemi, thanks so much for being with us. I want you to touch on the overall lessons that we should learn from what happened on the plains of Karbala many, many centuries ago.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. I'd like to express my condolences to you and all Shia Muslims and Muslims all around the world, and freedom seekers and truth seekers. Karbala has got multi-dimensions, and it's a multifaceted school of practice, thoughts, implementation. If you want to explore and examine aspects of Karbala, you can discuss the following as of great significance. The first one is awareness. Awareness in political, social, interpersonal, and personal levels. And when you talk about awareness, we're living in a world that right now everything is almost superficial. We're living in a world with perfunctory layers. And as a result of that, people may not experience that sense of high transcendental form of awareness, and Karbala has got a lot to do with implementing, actualizing, and demonstrating that sense of awareness for interpersonal and intrapersonal levels. In the meantime, when you look at Karbala as a school of thought, as a philosophy, it has lots of implications in terms of meaning making and how you get yourself connected to you and basically you relate to everybody in the world. So it has lots of lessons in terms of the philosophy, these epistemological and ontological layers of life, that what is your mission, what is your goal, what is it that you want to pursue in terms of etiological aspects of life. Are you going to be just focusing on here, or are you going to have some mission for hereafter? What are the dimensions between you and people around yourself that you're going to explore? In the meantime, devotion is of great significance because Imam Hussein alayhi salam demonstrates that for values you can sacrifice everything, including your own soul, in your own life, your own paraphernalia, your own family members and everything. So values stand at the top of the list. And again, what we have in the world today in terms of deficiencies is that values are going to be downgraded. Values are not taken into account, and as a result of that, in terms of family problems, international problems, national problems, issues around the world, all of them have got this focus on lack of values. Mm-hmm. And Karbala has got a lot to do and a lot to say in terms of values as an inextricable part of life. We are ineluctably and indisputably, unquestionably tied to this realm of values in terms of what we are and how we are and what we're going to become in the process of our self-actualization and self-fulfillment. In the meantime, another lesson that we can get from a psychological perspective is the language of patience, is the language of perseverance, is the language of passion, is the language of commitment. People are sometimes living in the world without having any passion, and Karbala offers everybody your passion, your ebullience, the sense of what is it that you could be parched with thirst in terms of pursuing your values and seeking those pristine, authentic aspects of life that are going to present you a genuine form of way, you know, of being.
Well, let's look at that from the psychological well-being perspective, the philosophy, if one wants to say a Husseini philosophy. and people who adhere to those principles, and you put it in the whole scheme of things today, do they fare very well, or how do you see it in the world today?
Well, as a matter of fact, Imam Hussein's school of thought is not just for the past. It is going to be lively. It is going to be brim with emotional, cognitive, behavioral messages, not only for the past, but also for today and for tomorrow. The reason for that is that it touches upon the bare bone essentials of human being. It focuses on the cosmological, the global aspect of human beings. It focuses on what constitutes a human being. And as a result of that, it does not just focus on the perfunctory aspect of life. It does not focus on the superficial manifestation or sedimentation of life. It has a deep, a recondite, rigorous contemplation in terms of what is life all about, you know. And accordingly, it just deals with the fundamental significance aspect of human life, and as a result of that, it could be well manifested, it could be well crystallized in interpersonal and intrapersonal realms of life, and people can take a leaf out of that book for the well-being, because you know, nowadays we're having this lack of well-being as a result of division of self. Health and wholeness come from the same word, etymologically. So the more you lose your wholeness, the more you lose your health. And in our world today, we've got this sporadic, scattered sedimentation of everything that we do not have that sense of wholeness. And Karbala develops that sense of wholeness. It brings humanity into full plate and full aspect of personality, and as a result of that, that division goes away. People get that sense of marshaling their forces to mobilize all forms of potential so that they can have that consummate, comprehensive understanding of self.
Okay, Sayed Khoshchesh, going back to what we were talking about and the leadership aspect. I'm so sorry about the audio difficulties that we're having. Hopefully that has been taken.
All right. So we were talking about the importance of the leadership in a society, in a Shiite society. Now, you take the leader away from such a society like Iran, then they will be much vulnerable. That's why they target the Iranian leader very often. And that's why, as you mentioned, at the beginning of the revolution, They tried hard to undermine Imam Khomeini. Now, these days, the leader, just a few weeks ago, he warned that against the penetration of the United States through the nuclear deal. So for some people, it might seem that we panic when we want to talk to foreign or to the Western powers. But this has happened very frequently throughout the Shiite history. And back to the Karbala story, some people, I know that some of our viewers may not be, you know, they may not be acquainted with the Shiite history. So they are asking themselves, why are they mourning for a person, for a leader, like one of my friends or colleagues? He asked me, You're mourning for a person. Who is he? And I said, he was one of our greatest leaders. And he said, when did he die? I didn't get that in the news. And I said, 14 centuries ago. And he was asking, why are you still crying for him? So I started explaining that this kind of mourning is different from normal mourning. Now, you may see very catastrophic scenes and you start crying, okay? Karbala scene, theatrically speaking, it's a catastrophe. It's a very big catastrophe, and you start crying as soon as you portray that scene. But our crying as Shiites, it's not because of the worldly things. First of all, it has different meanings. One of the meanings is that I'm sorry for you, that you were right, your cause was noble. I side with you, and I'm against your enemies. Even after 14 centuries, you asked 14 centuries ago, is there anybody out there to help me? There were many people at the beginning of this journey
many people accompanied him, but they left him stage by stage. How and why? Some for money. At the beginning, some people thought, okay, he would get to Karbala, he would become a ruler, and to Kufa, and he would become a ruler and a caliph. And I'll be maybe a commander, somebody in his government. But little by little, they realized that there would be nothing for them standing in there, staying in there. So what happened? They left him. Some others were in doubt. So they thought, okay, now that we are few and Yazid's army is very big, so we will lose. What's the difference if we stay or not? So they left them. And the third group, they were bought. Many of his army, I mean, those who were accompanying Hussein, they were bought. So they were after worldly goals. So they all left him. They didn't realize who Hussein was. So Hussein was left because of the penetration of money, of the force of the enemy, of the bullying and the force of the caliph, mm-hmm. Yazid and his army. And some of his followers, they were not even bullied. You know, they were not even intimidated. They were not bought. They had set a condition for accompanying him. They told him, okay, Hussein, we will be with you. If you need us, we will fight alongside you. But if, in final days, it becomes clear that you are going to lose the war, then we will leave. We will not stay because it wouldn't make any difference. So let us leave. And this happened. This actually happened for a couple of people. They accompanied Imam Hussein to the last moment, just before the dawn, this day, today, 14 centuries ago, and they left him very easily. And who lost? Hussein? No, of course not. Today we can understand that he was not the loser. The loser was the person who died a couple of years later. But he couldn't stay with his imam, with his leader. Shiites all throughout the history have seen these scenes, and they've learned a lot that they should never leave their leader. Now, these days, when we think of the United States and its influence, when we talk about penetration of the United States through the nuclear deal, we're not just talking about force, we're not just talking about money, we're also talking about the global impact that the United States mainstream media is leaving on society, human society, including the Iranian people. And I know you're short of time, so I'll explain the
right,
rest
I was just
later.
About to say, I'll pick up with you on that. I want to cross back over here to Sayyid Fatemi. Sayyid Khoshtesh talked about the type of mourning, the grieving, the tears that are shed almost 1,400 years ago, a unique situation in general from a psychological perspective, that this tradition has been able to be kept alive, and the significance of actually transferring that generation after generation, that even today, you can look at these pictures right now. We have live images from Karbala, Iraq, and of course, throughout Iran, we are seeing images come in. And you'll see whether it's an older person in their 90s or a child at 7, but you'll see these tears, real tears, actually falling from them. The significance of that from a psychological perspective, sociological perspective, that this was able to be transferred, this raw feeling of loss and sadness because of what took place.
Yeah, to understand this and to answer the question, we may go through the analysis of different types of crying or different types of sadness. In DSM, for example, we talk about grief and sadness. If you've got that sort of sadness or grief, after a while, it might be exposed to some sort of pathological problem. But this is a horse of a different color. This is a different story. The reason for that is that when you have this sense of crying, the sense of sadness, the sense of tears and everything, it is of great significance because it moves in line with the tintinnabulation, with the echoing sound of human beings in terms of its foundational components. People's eyes are rife with tears. They cry because they get the sense of connectedness to that authentic sense of what constitutes a human being. You know that in the philosophical sense of Islamic thought of Shiites, we have the propositions demonstrating that Imam Hussein was an impeccable human being, was a perfect human being. And as a result of that, he was connected to the source in terms of this impeccable aspect more than anybody else. And as a result of that, when you see that essence, when you see that presence, when you see that authenticity, when you see that sense of belonging, that sense of connectedness, and in the meantime, you can see that he is overcoming all forms of selfishness, all forms of egoism, all forms of egotism. There is no hubris. There is no overbearing attitude. It is just the full, exhaustive, comprehensive form of devotion in its comprehensive aspect. This is going to allow everybody to cry, not just for one particular aspect, but because this has got a great manifestation in terms of constitutional aspects of what makes a human being, and how the etiological aspect of a human being can be well connected to the inner voice of everybody. This is going to be a great manifestation of great significance because it allows everybody to somehow dwell into the inner part of self, to linger in the most explicit and implicit abodes of human life, and understands and acknowledges how this could be of great significance in terms of the overall global aspect of what is it about decency, what is it about being a human being, and what is it about the virtues. And when you see that all these manifestations of virtues, all its components are just gathered and accumulated and are manifested and crystallized in one human being, and this human being is going to just seek that sense of freedom, that sense of authenticity, away from any carnal desires, away from any sense of pretentious, ostentatious, or frivolous aspect of thought. This makes everybody, even with a little bit of connectedness to that inner voice, to hear that tintinnabulation and to expose, to get that sense of authenticity and to get that sense of liveliness to cry.
Well, looking at what you have just said, if we look at this world of, perhaps we can say, confusion right now, earlier we had talked about with Said Hoshesh that right is right and wrong is wrong. However, picking up on what you've just said, that inner self, that voice telling you basically what is right and what is wrong. However, we see entities, terrorist groups now, such as ISIS, Daesh, and others, and we see, unfortunately, that they are appealing to some who call themselves Muslims. So what happens to that inner voice that when Islam tells us how we should treat human beings with respect, but then that these entities can actually encourage and actually do heinous crimes, commit heinous crimes in the name of Islam? What happens to that inner voice? What happens here?
You know, there are a number of things that we have to say as preambles. Number one is that everything can be abused, everything can be misused, and everything can be exploited. Mm-hmm. So we got to have that distinction right at the beginning. And the other thing is that when we have this focus on understanding the inner voice, Imam Hussein alayhi salam is the manifestation of compassion. If you go and look and examine his father's life, Imam Ali alayhi salam, you can see that the school of thought is basically demonstrating compassion, and that compassion-based form of life demonstrates that you should not encroach upon the rights of any human being. I mean, you can get this sense from letters of Imam Ali to Malik Ashtar when he's appointing him as the leader of Egypt, as the governor general, and he says that when you get down there, you may see people that may not necessarily comply with you in terms of doctrines and, you know, philosophy of life and everything, but bear in mind that there are, those guys are creatures, and you have to have full respect for them. You should not be imposing, you should not encroach upon the rights. When we look at the rights of animals, for example, in the language of Imam Ali, he reiterates that when you've got, for example, you want to gaze them out or something, make sure that you lead them and walk them through the areas that are fresh and beautiful and green and everything. So how could a school of thought that is so meticulous and splits the hair and read between the lines in terms of rights of even animals could demonstrate any encroachment against human beings? So you could see Imam Hussein alayhi salam as the manifestation of compassion. He even addresses his enemies on Ashura, and he's using that language of compassion. In the night before, in Taswa, a number of them come and he welcomes them. He says that, you know, he's not using any language of force, he's not using any language of atrocity or ferocity or something. And it's interesting that in the night of Ashura, he addresses his companions and he says that we all are going to be martyred tomorrow. Anybody wants to go, he can go. And then he turns away his looks in order to say non-verbally that I don't want you to feel uncomfortable. If you want to go, you can go, and you're most welcome to go. So his language is based on that sense of compassion, and that compassion needs to be well understood and scrutinized in a true Islamic form. Now, the group that you mentioned, ISIS and, you know, other types of extremists, that they use the name Islam, they haven't got anything to do with Islam. It's just a pretentious, ostentatious form to bamboozle people, to fool people, because obviously whenever you want to have a project, whenever you want to have a plan or something, in order to get that appealability to people, you have to use it. You have to use some sacred, holy form of language or something so that it might sound commendable. And that inner voice is going to have a salient distinction. The inner voice inside everybody that is going to be connected to the language of fitra, human nature, is going to always provide everybody with the language of composure, equanimity, tranquility, and that language of authenticity. And that authenticity is going to provide you with that sense of distinction of truth from, you know, the pseudo forms of truth, the bogus, the fake form. And as a result of that, people who are really living in that, you said it beautifully, Husseini's form of life, they would have that sense of connectedness to that inner voice in an authentic manner. And that mm-hmm. authenticity is not going to be shrouded by any form of bogus, frivolous, you know, form of utilitarianism or exploitation or any form of manipulation that is going to manifest itself in the world and is going to be misleading people.
Well said, Hushchesh, back to what you were talking about and leadership. And we look at right now, again, the Islamic Republic and surrounding countries right now. Lots of problems and chaos, actually, in many parts of the Muslim world, and seems to be lots of confusion. We see now, almost on an unfortunate regular basis, that people are killed as they're praying inside of the mosque in Muslim countries. We see so many injustices being done in the name of Islam, and yet we see almost an island of security and peace here inside of the Islamic Republic. And we know that many of these plots, the target of many, if not all of these plots, have actually been to destroy the Islamic Republic of Iran. What's the difference? Why are we able to sit and relax here in the studio in Tehran and any other cities, basically, inside of Iran today? And we see millions throughout the country today having these commemoration ceremonies, and not a whole lot of concern that they're going to be blown up, they're going to be targeted or whatever. So what's the difference?
Well, we talked about it earlier. This is the role of the leadership in Shiite Islam. This shows that Iranian Shiites have learned their lesson from the history. Of course, as we said earlier, human beings, they were given 124,000 prophets they didn't appreciate. They were taken away. 11 imams, they were taken away. Now, what remains is the last imam. And according to Shiite beliefs, if you treat your leaders, just leaders, religious leaders, in a correct way, then he will come back. He will reappear. Until then, he will not. But let us talk about what is happening these days. Just last week, the Iranian Supreme Leader reminded something that has been on the agenda of the United States ever since the nuclear talks started. Just 2.5 years ago, a senator who has played a very major role in imposing the crude sanctions and banking sanctions on Iran, he said he was approached by AP and he was asked, what happens if Iran dismantles all its nuclear program? What would happen? Would you pick up all the sanctions? He said, then, of course, we're talking about 2.5 years ago. He said, no, we would keep him under a different prefix, could be ballistic missiles. And then he was asked, okay, what would happen next? He said, okay, if they change and they stop their ballistic missile program, we would keep the same sanctions and even intensify them under human rights pretexts. And he was asked, okay, why? Why do you want to keep sanctions? He said, when the sanctions work, then we would go on and on and on until the Islamic Republic of Iran, the Islamic Republic, is toppled or it changes in nature. That's the warning that the leader has been reiterating all throughout the last year. He has been warning people and officials that you gotta take good care not to be influenced by the United States through economy, through the media, through the nuclear deal or politics, whatever, because they intend to change the nature of the Islamic Republic. Just last week he said, okay, they don't want to topple the Islamic Republic. No, they don't oppose the form. There is nothing wrong with it. They just want to empty the content and keep the shell. That's the shell that we started talking about mm-hmm. an hour ago, that ISIL, Daesh, Jabhat al-Nusra, and others, they have the forms like Yazid. They keep the forms, but empty of any kind of content. Remember that we just said that, unfortunately, they're preaching Islam that they don't know. Many of them have embraced Islam just maybe for 2-3 months. Mm-hmm. According to those two German media that I said, Boko Haram, a main Salafi Takfiri movement, their leader and their members, they cannot even read the Holy Quran, let alone understanding it. And they are killing people and they kidnap girls under the name of Islam. They portray Islam in the whole world like this, that this is the Islam that we want. In this Islam, women cannot, they are not allowed to study. They should stay at home and serve men. But take a look at what happens after this evening of Ashura. What Zainab does after that. Zainab is the example, the full example of a woman who has been brought up in Shiite school of thought. She is the one who accomplishes Hussein's mission. She stands up in front of Yazid at his palace. He has invited ambassadors of foreign countries, all the noble people of his time. Everybody is there in Damascus. And she stands up after 40 days of walking, of slavery, of slashes that she had been given. And after 40 days that her brother and others, they've been decapitated the way that we talked about, and their heads have been put on spears, and they've been moving ahead of her eyes. They were shown to her and Hussein's 3-year-old daughter. For 40 years, they've been moving from Karbala in eastern Iraq to western Syria.
40 days.
Now they get there, and in front of Yazid, She rises and she speaks for some minutes, and she turns the situation completely. So everybody understands the reality. This is the kind of Islam, this is the kind of woman that has been brought up in the Shiite school of thought, and this is the kind of Islam that they are introducing to the whole world today in those lands. This is the shell that they are introducing to the Muslim, to the whole world through Daesh, Nusra, Wahhabi school of thought that is preached by Saudi Arabia. That's why they don't care about over 7,000 people were killed or they died in Mina stampede, but they didn't show any kind of care. People's bodies were out in the streets for 12 hours, and they didn't allow anyone to get there to help them, or some of them could have been alive, could have stayed alive if they were given a little water, drinking water, and they didn't allow them to do so. They didn't allow not only the Iranians, the Nigerians, the Pakistanis, I've spoken to them, those pilgrims, they said that if they allowed us to do so, we would do it, and many of our friends would already be, would be alive. Now, they don't care for human lives in there. Now, how many people were there in the Mina stampede? 3-4 million people maximum. Today, in Karbala, you could see millions of people. In Arba'in, you see around 10 million people in a country that is under the direct attack of the terrorists. But you don't see anything like that happens in a small area between the two shrines of Hazrat Abbas and Imam Hussein. They are commuting. You can see the pictures, the images. They are moving so fast, and nothing like this happens. Many of these Daesh, ISIL, Jabhat al-Nusra, and others, or the Wahhabi, Salafi, and Takfiri groups, terrorist groups, are trying to blast this congregation, but they fail, and so many people are there. They are taking part in the procession, which is very important for them, and hundreds of cameras are covering them, but you don't see such a thing happen. This is the kind of Islam that has the content. And this is the kind of the Wahhabi school that is preached by Saudi Arabia.
Okay,
is the one that
me,
has kept the shell.
Stay with me, Said Hoshesh. Thank you so much. Interesting conversation we're having here in the studio this on the 10th day of Muharram, the day of Ashura. And as said, Hoshesh just talked about Karbala and how crowded it is today. We're going to cross over to Karbala, joined by our correspondent on the ground, Altaf Ahmed. Altaf, what a wonderful place you are today. Please take it away.
Well, today is the 10th day of Muharram, the peak of the Ashura commemorations. This day is called Ashura, and it marks the day when the grandson of the Prophet of Islam and third Shia Imam, Imam Hussein bin Ali, was martyred alongside 72 of his companions at the hands of the army of the vicious Yazid. Imam Hussein had went out in a revolution against Yazid, who under his reign, he was the Umayyad Caliph at the time, under his reign, the Arabian Peninsula, the Islamic community in the Arabian Peninsula was plagued with corruption and was plagued with injustice and cruelty. Imam Hussein issued his very famous call saying, I did not go out in arrogance or calling for power. I went out calling for reform in the nation of my grandfather, that being the Prophet of Islam, Muhammad. Imam Hussein led an army made up of tens, only from his family and companions, and stood in the face of Yazid's army of 30,000 men strong. Some narrations even say 80,000, but the battle was unequal. He was pitted along with tens against tens of thousands, and still he did not hesitate, and he fought very fiercely for his cause. He fought falsehood. It is for this reason that his memory is yet to be forgotten. Over 14 centuries have passed, and the Imam's martyrdom is being commemorated year in, year out, as his sister Sayyida Zainab had vowed to his killer that the remembrance of her brother and his companions will not be erased. Imam Hussein sent out a lot of lessons by going out on that day and fighting that unequal battle against the army of Yazid. Imam Hussein wanted to show that a leader can too be a martyr and can and his family are not of more worth than the normal soldiers or other soldiers. He wanted to show an example of how a leader does indeed lead a revolution, and he did. He led an epic battle against the army of Yazid. This epic battle has left a mark on the hearts and minds of many. We've heard a lot about a lot of authors, about a lot of well-known writers who have spoken about Imam Hussein, including Mahatma Gandhi, who said, "I have learned from Imam Hussein how to be patient and how to be victorious." Imam Hussein forever changed the concept of victory, which is known to humanity as the most powerful wins or the one with the highest number of army. Imam Hussein showed that no, blood can win over sword, and it has, because the legacy that Imam Hussein has left has definitely surpassed whatever Yazid has left behind. And it seems that the impact that Imam Hussein has left on people is not just exclusive to the people of Iraq, because here in Iraq we've seen millions of people take part in these commemorations year in, year out. According to local officials and to the director of the Imam Hussein Holy Shrine, Sayyid Afdal al-Shami, he told Press TV that last year, on the day of Ashura alone, up to 3 million people took part in the commemorations. This year, with what has come thus far, or with what has appeared thus far, it seems that this year's numbers are going to surpass last year's numbers, and we're going to see an even bigger turnout this year. Right now, what you're seeing behind me is the people of Iraq, or the mourners, not only the people of Iraq, from all over the world. Mourners are running the famous run of Tweirij. It's from the door of Tweirij, which is around 5 kilometers away from the holy shrines of Imam Hussein and Abul Fadl al-Abbas, his half-brother, here in the holy city of Karbala. They are running to the shrines of the Imam and his half-brother. This one symbolizes a rise of the devout followers of this leader to his call, because we know that Imam Hussein once stood on the plains of Karbala, the plains which are now hidden under very tall buildings. He stood and he said, he asked the question, or he issued the call, "Will no one answer our call? Will no one help us become victorious?" And it seems that these people are here to tell Imam Hussein that we are here, and if we had the chance to redo things, or if we had been with you on that day, we would have turned out and we would have backed you, we would have supported you in fighting that battle. Some of these people have run 5 to 6 kilometers, that's approximately 3 to 4 miles, some of them barefoot. Their tears are running down their eyes, their faces, and a lot of them, they're running in the blazing heat. Of course, you know, Iraq, it's not, when it comes to the weather, it's blazing heat, so the people here, it doesn't seem that these things have stopped them, and you can hear their roars in the background. They're calling Ya Hussein, they're calling on the third Shia Imam, and they're telling him that we are here, we are present. And to every time there will be a Yazid, this is what Imam Hussein, this is the lesson that Imam Hussein left behind, that for every time there will be a Yazid. So it is a requirement, or it is required of each and every one of us to be or to walk the path of Imam Hussein against each and every Yazid, against each and every tyrant. We must fight until the last breath, even if we have to give our families, even if we have to sacrifice our own blood, our own lives, for a righteous cause. No price is too high.
Well, thank you very much, Altaf Ahmed. Altaf, you're on the ground there. I'm just wondering, of course, obviously, the type of emotion that's being expressed and talking to some of the mourners there in Karbala today. Tell me some of the perspectives, the feeling that, especially a lot of them are not Iraqis and probably have not participated in this procession on Ashura, the type of perspectives that you're hearing on the ground there today.
Well, Marzia, it's really amazing to see how Imam Hussein has impacted the life of each and every last one of these mourners. Each of them, they speak different languages and they've come from different countries, and to each of them they have a different cause. We've met with Muslims who came all the way from Pakistan and who told us that Imam Hussein and the revolution of Imam Hussein taught them that taught them how to cope with the prejudice killing of Shia Muslims and Muslims in general who are not affiliated connected with the extremist terrorist groups such as the Taliban and Al-Qaeda and so on, they told us that it is because Imam Hussein has sacrificed his blood, it sort of made their tragedy to them. It made their tragedy or their plight trivial. That's according to what many or to a number of the people here we met, they told us. You also met people from Saudi Arabia, from Qatif, from Ihsa, from eastern regions who are calling for equality among other, along with equality with other citizens in the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia. They're telling us that it is because of Imam Hussein, or it is Imam Hussein who led this model of revolution and who laid out the or paved the way for the revolution that they're carrying out in their country. Same goes for the people of Bahrain. Same goes for the people of Yemen, for the people of Lebanon, who have for decades suffered from Israeli aggression, Israeli occupation, decades long. For many of them, it is the slogans raised by Imam Hussein, Hayat minna dhilla, how far from us is humiliation, that has kept them going and kept them strong. It is because of the tragedy and because of what has happened with Imam Hussein that each of us feels like whatever we go through in life, it just really seems trivial compared to what this Imam had gone through. And I would like to lament here or to comment on the issue of Sayyida Zainab. Mm-hmm. Sayyida Zainab, we know that in these days in particular, her shrine in Sham, in Syria, there are a lot of people out there trying to turn Sham into another Jannatul Baqiyah, similar to what's happening in Saudi Arabia, where the Wahhabi regime had destroyed the Muslims and destroyed the shrines or the graves of the family of the Prophet of Islam. There are similar extremist hardline ideologies which adopt the Wahhabi ideology, or similar extremist groups which adopt the Wahhabi ideology, who have since day one, since the crisis began in Syria, have threatened Sayyida Zainab and have vowed that they wrote on the walls of her shrines, "You will fall with the fall of the regime." To many of the people here, coming to Imam Hussein is also a vow to Sayyida Zainab that we will not have another Jannatul Baqiyah and Sham. Mm-hmm. This is something very important. We've seen a lot of Syrians here, Syrians who could not take part in the commemorations taking place in Sham at the shrine of Sayyida Zainab. They've come here instead, and they're coming here to renew their vow of allegiance to Imam Hussein and to Abu al-Fadl al-Abbas. And we know that Abu al-Fadl al-Abbas was, in the eyes of Sayyida Zainab, her protector and her shield. And when he was martyred, her back was broken. And so they are also raising the slogan, "We are all your Abbas Zainab. We will not your back break once again. You will not be the Umm al-Masaib, the mother of miseries, or the woman who has the most miseries in your death as you were in your life."
Thank you so much, Altaf Ahmad, for that update out of Karbala today. Quite a scene. And Sayyid Fatimah, our correspondent there, talked about some of the extremist groups that we're seeing today. We have seen unbelievable scenes carried out in front of cameras, with cameras rolling, whether it's beheadings or burning people alive. So many unbelievable scenes. From the psychological perspective, I want to look at, why do you think that these terrorist groups have used the media in the way that they have, and the type of message that they're trying to get out by doing this in the name of Islam?
Well, from a classical conditioning perspective, when you've got these images, the bottom line is that you somehow associate these images with Islam. So if somebody, for example, hasn't got any idea of what Islam is all about, and he or she is exposed to these types of images, images of atrocities, bellicosities, hostilities, inexpressible form of catastrophic events by the name of Islam, at the end of the day, you would somehow, based on all these associations, you would say that, well, Islam is epitomized in the context of atrocity and bellicosity, so and so. So, and that's exactly what the clandestine, surreptitious message of all these programs and projects are all about. You see, when we look at Imam Hussein alayhi salam's philosophy of life, you could see that peace and tranquility are inextricably tied to that philosophy. And that philosophy is going to provide everybody with that sense of composure, with that sense of tranquility, suggesting that as long as you have not established that peace within yourself, you would not be able to offer that peace to people around yourself. Now, these so-called extremist groups of Wahhabism and Daesh and, you know, those names are misusing and abusing the name Islam and try to distort it. But in order to do this, they obviously appear on the surface by the name of Islam, but deep down, you can have, that program of ulterior form of project that is followed by all those atrocities and bellicosities, suggesting and implementing that Islam is going to be associated with these negativities and, you know, atrocities that are going to be attributed to that sense of Islam. And therefore, I said that the first lesson of Imam Hussein's school of thought is that lesson of awareness, that lesson of contemplation, that sense of reflexivity, that people need to understand what you see needs to be contemplated, what you see needs to be examined and explored. An unexamined life is not worth living. And as a result of that, people need that sense of metacognition, that sense of deliberate awareness, that sense of mindfulness to understand what is it that is happening, and that global awareness is of great significance today because it allows everybody to understand not just the surface but also the recondite layers that somehow are not disclosed or shrouded in ulterior forms of projects.
Well, it's interesting that you said that, but actually when we look at the world today, we seem to see forces that want to make sure that people do not reach that point of reflection. We see constant attacks, either from a psychological perspective, sociological perspective, to keep people busy with very unimportant things, as if forces that be do not want people to connect those dots, do not want people to understand the goals in life, as you said. We see an infiltration, whether it's of various drugs or whether from game perspective, whatever. We have so many so-called forms of entertainment, with the majority of them existing in the world today, actually preventing us from reflecting. The role of all of this in actually preventing some people from getting to that point of being able to contemplate the meaning of it all and the ultimate goal?
Well, the goal is when you've got multitasking, you won't be able to use your energy in a mindful manner. And as a result of that, even from a physiological aspect, if you put your hand here, you've got insula. And people assume that when they've got this multitasking, they can do at the same time too many things. But the truth of the matter is that you're not using too many things because of the resources that you have. Every time you're doing multitasking, you're consuming a lot of energy and you're misusing them, and you're not, really effectively dealing with them, because it's like turning off and turning on and off. And as a result of that, you would end up with exhaustion and, misuse of a lot of energy or something. So the bottom line is that focus, that concentration, that perspective management. And people, as you mentioned, are concealed to oblivion. I mean, lots of things are concealed to oblivion because when people are mindlessly lingering in the world, they would not be able to get back and sit back and say, well, what is the etiological goal of my life? And as a result of that, they could be easily manipulated, exploited, and exposed to utilitarian projects and programs. That's why Imam Hussein's philosophy of life offers everybody the main questions of what is it that you're doing? What is your position in life? What is it that you're trying to attain? Are you going to be just summed up in the materialistic aspects of life, or do you define and translate something else beyond this, superficial aspect of life? Are you going to be epitomized in just a mere manifestation of what you see in terms of consumerism and utilitarianism, or you see something else as a transcendental aspect of yourself? Are you going to be just connected to your own first of self that is going to be associated with all these manifestations in the world of materialism, or you would have some attention towards the second self that is telling you there is something else, there is a mission, there is a goal, you're not just here for the carnal desires, the so-called manifestation and sedimentation of this life. There is something else, and that something else is of great significance for everybody to receive that sense of contemplation. And as you just pointed out, When people are busy and when people are engaged in different forms of quotidian, mundane, you know, hackneyed layers of life, they may not have that sense of rigorous analysis. They may not sit back and they say, well, what is it that I'm doing? And as a result of that, people are living in different forms of alienation. And one of the greatest alienations of our time is self-alienation. People are disconnected so much from themselves. They are so much identifying themselves with whatever is the pseudo, the fake, the bogus manifestation. And if they just go back and say, well, am I really identifying myself with myself? They see that the answer is no. That's why Imam Sadiq alayhi salam has got a wonderful hadith saying that when people leave this world, some people leave the world as slaves and some people are free. And those who are free take a leaf out of Imam Hussein's school of thought. They abide by the principle of understanding your position, understanding your mission, understanding your goal, understanding your philosophy of life, understanding how you get connected to yourself and how you relate to people around yourself. Because Imam Hussein's philosophy of life talks about basically the components of relatedness, whether relatedness is to God, as you see that, for example, in around the noon in Ashura, around almost the same time, he starts prayer. And he says wonderful, remarkably conspicuous, beautiful statements saying that, I always remember you. I always rely on you in the midst of hardships, in the midst of catastrophic events, in the midst of all forms of calamities. You are the sole supporter. And you can't believe that, you know, that somebody who is afflicted with all these hardships, in the midst of all these hardships, in the midst of all these catastrophic events, that even one of them is good enough to just make one psychologically paralyzed. He says, I am relying on you. You're the only supporter. In the midst of all hardships, you always brought me peace and tranquility. I could not rely on anybody except you. So many problems, so many catastrophic events that occurred, and enemies were laughing, and friends were dissipating, and pain, you know, went up, and anguish increased, and sadness pervasively happened to be the case. But you came and saved me. You're the manifestation of emancipation. These are the words of a man who is challenged by the most tragic events in life. And in the midst of all these ups and downs, in the midst of all these turmoils, in the midst of all these tumultuous, you know, happenings, he is just saying that language because he's so presently, authentically, genuinely connected to his inner self, because that self is not translated within just the manifestation of the ulterior aspects of the utilitarian world, because that self is coming from the upper part, and that self is going to be celebrated. You can see that commemoration in Imam Hussein's words, that even when he is about to get martyred, his lips start talking about labbaik, Allahumma labbaik, which suggests that I comply with you. I comply with you, the Savior, God, the Creator. He talks about this monotheism that is going to be crystallized in every corner of one's life when he or she is philosophically, psychologically, cognitively, and behaviorally connected to that source, because that source is of great significance. You can see, you know, people may love you, but if you wake up, for example, them right after midnight, they say, well, let me talk to you after, you know, the morning or something. But he's the one who can always be, you know, referred to. He's the one who can always be communicated with. You know, he is not taking a nap, he's not sleeping, he's not catching Z's, he's always alive. That manifestation of that liveliness, that manifestation of that quintessential presence, the presence of God, is of great significance. Therefore, Ashura talks about getting this reconciliatory approach, this compromising, effective approach of two types of self, the self that is going to be stuck in this world, and the self that talks about and promises that you're not just this, you know, you're not here to just get yourself satiated mm-hmm. and satisfied through these, you know, the manifestation of the array of carnal desires. There is something else. So Ashura has got this sense of connectedness, that sense of elevation of self, that sense of consummation of wholeness, that sense of you're not just here to, you know, go ahead with the fulfillment of what you see.
Okay.
You're beyond what you see. And as a result of that, the more we get that sense, the more we get that sense of celebration and commendation.
Well, speaking of a consciousness of self, Sayyid Khoshesh, we look at Zainab, the sister of Imam Hussein, after the tragedy that she had witnessed, after the killings and beheadings and of her relatives and friends, and then of course her brother himself. She's saying, all I've seen today was beauty. That's an amazing statement, an absolute amazing statement if we analyze that on a material world level. Most people probably could not understand, what does that mean? What does that mean? Explain why she would say that. How could she say that after all the tragedy that took place that day?
She has seen complete devotion. In worldly terms, you cannot define that, because you've seen, as a woman, you've seen bloodshed. Your two sons have been slaughtered. Your most beloved brother, Hussein, has been beheaded, and they rode, horses rode on his crushed body. And all your other brothers who were there, Muhammad, Own, Jafar, Abbas, half-brothers, they were all killed the same way. All the male members of your family, all those who have been relatives of Imam Ali, who have remained from the Prophet, they have all been killed and slaughtered completely. Well, for a normal person, when you see such a thing, you cannot tolerate that. Suppose just one scene of Karbala. There is a father, all his family members, he himself, and his six-month-old boy, they have been thirsty for 3 days. Now, he takes his six-month-old baby into his arm and takes him to the battlefield and says, okay, he is thirsty and his mom doesn't have any milk to feed him. If you think that I want water for myself, please take this baby boy, satiate him, bring him back to me. And then there comes an arrow. Some say it was three-sided. Some others say that it had three branches, whatever. Cuts the throat of the six-month-old baby. If you were a father, just imagine, after all these hardships, you have such a baby, six-month-old baby. He's been thirsty for 3 days. When you portray this scene, it's intolerable. You cannot tolerate that, let alone experiencing it in person. Zainab also has seen such a thing happening to his nephews. And she has been brought up in the same family, in the same school of thought that Hussein has been brought up. She understands the meaning of devotion. She's been brought up in the school of thought of the Prophet, of Zahra, the daughter of the Prophet, of Ali, alayhi salam, the first Shiite Imam. She is as connected to her inner self, as Dr. Fatemi said, as Hussein did. That's the difference. Now, because I know we are out of time.
One more minute, sir.
Okay, I need 20 seconds. Which camera is mine? Which one is mine? Could you show me? I am Sayyid, and Sayyid means that I am from the same blood of the Prophet, and he is too. But that doesn't mean that we understand Islam and Hussein better than anyone else. If you are not a Muslim and you are watching this program, I do believe that it's not because of Press TV or me. I believe you've been invited by Hussein. He has invited you to learn a lesson from him. In the final moments of his life, he said, if you're not a follower of any religion, at least be a free man. Don't be bullied by powers. Don't ever try to be fooled by money. Don't let those who are wealthy to buy you. Please stay free if you are a human and you want to remain a human. Now, you as viewers of this program, you've been invited by Hussein. To hear his name, maybe you'll start a quest for life. Maybe you will start a quest for a new life. Maybe you will understand new meanings. Now it's the time. If you hear his name, just pick up a book, an article, go through the internet, or Google search it. It won't take much time. But hear his story as the real Imam, as the person who represents Islam truly, in the true sense of the matter. If you understand, you want to understand Islam and what the Iranian Supreme Leader asked you to study Islam and do not listen to anyone in the West or in the East, and go study Islam for yourself, please pick up a book about Imam Hussein, or at least get more information about Karbala, and you will understand what the real Islam means, and you will understand the content of Shiaism and Islam.